Yes, we will finish this last bit of chapter 7, Standards of Conduct and Spiritual Freedom. All conduct and action are part of the movement of a power, a force infinite and divine in its origin and secret sense and will, even though the forms of it we see seem inconscient or ignorant, material, vital, mental, finite, which is working to bring out progressively something of the divine and infinite in the obscurity of the individual and collective nature. So here's a picture of the universe. This is cosmology. Whatever deports itself in this world is actually driven by a secret conscious will. There is a supreme existent which has established through its own power the self-extension of its self-illumined being into what seems to be dark, into all these stadia of existence, material, vital, mental, leading into the farther lights beyond. This immensity, no, it's more than an immensity, it's an infinity that has taken form, even the cosmic form, which seems so vast to us, however you measure it, is simply a fragment, an aspect of what is truly infinite, which has made itself manifest to the view. Manifest would mean even what is dark, not simply what is light, what is mental, but everything that has stepped forward into the cosmos is part of this mere fraction of the fullness of what is there. Puram, Puranam Madha, Puranam Idam. That is full, this is full. This is full of that. That's what makes it full. What makes it real is that it is derived from that reality. So, what action we have is through different roles in a relative world. Each aspect of individuality expresses and relates back to the larger whole, relating back to the one which constitutes the whole. Everything is energized and driven by the secret will. So there is, to the larger vision, to the penetrating eye, a sense of direction in what seems to be meaningless interaction. And it is revealed over the course of time that in this brute material world comes a living force. In this living bit of matter manifests the illumination of the mind, which for all of its darkness is still better than blindness. For all of its duality is still better than inconscience. And then, of course, there is the continuing evolution beyond the mind. So this is what he is describing here. This is a power. This is a Shakti. So he has brought into the discussion already in the first sentence of this last section the idea that there is a conscious power, referring back to his book written only a few years earlier, which is the basis of the ashram life. The book is the mother. So the Shakti is the core of the cosmos. This power is leading towards the light, but still through the ignorance. You remember in the mother how he describes that she leads everything according to its nature. According to the brand of ignorance that it follows, she leads it towards a larger illumination. And we just chanted that wonderful prayer from the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad. Asato ma satgamaya, tamaso ma jyotirgamaya, mrityor ma amritam gamaya. Tamaso ma jyotirgamaya, lead me from the darkness to the light. This power is leading towards the light, but still through the ignorance. So even thousands of years ago, and this prayer that the Brihadaranyaka records was already old by the time they happened upon it and said, this ought to be remembered. This is essential to our being, to recognize that we grow from darkness to light. We move from the death of materiality into the eternity, the timeless, the immortality of spiritual awareness. And we move, therefore, to real being. It leads man first through his needs and desires. It guides him next through enlarged needs and desires, modified and enlightened by a mental and moral ideal. It is preparing to lead him to a spiritual realization that overrides these things and yet fulfills and reconciles them in all that is divinely true in their spirit and purpose. It transforms the needs and desires into a divine will and ananda. It transforms the mental and moral aspiration into the powers of truth and perfection that are beyond them. So here's a cosmic march that crosses a threshold and escapes the ignorance and the duality of the triple world that we live in commonly, and then is capable, therefore, because it's crossed that threshold, of transforming what seems to be a desire into a master will, what seems to be the mere pursuit of pleasure into the experience of a unifying ananda, transforming the light, the moral pretensions that the mind creates into real illumination, into a true ordered perfection. So, will is power, chit-shakti. The mind, of course, the idea, represents the light of the supramental. Each thing finds its way into even the articulation of ignorance, searches for that thing that it represents. It substitutes for the divided straining of the individual nature, for the passion and strife of the separate ego, the calm, profound, harmonious, and happy law of the universalized person within us, the central being, the spirit that is a portion of the Supreme Spirit. The Atman writ large is the universal self. The individual aspect of the universal self is the jiva, jivatman, in Sri Aurobindo's terminology. He prefers that term for it. But it is an amsha, a portion of that, just as if you took a fantastic diamond, but there were uncountable numbers of facets within it. Each facet would represent an individual truth, but yet would be part of that whole diamond, isn't it? So the individuality does not step away from the universality, and all of them together form a wonderful collective. That's why we marvel at all the facets of a beautifully cut diamond. It represents something that we aspire to achieve. It's a symbol of what we shall be. this true person in us, because it is universal, does not seek its separate gratification, but only asks in its outward expression in nature its growth to its real stature, the expression of its inner divine self, that transcendent spiritual power and presence within it, which is one with all and in sympathy with each thing and creature, and with all the collective personalities and powers of the divine existence. And yet it transcends them, and is not bound by the egoism of any creature or collectivity, or limited by the ignorant controls of their lower nature. So this is a contextual realization. Note, one with all, that's the very signature of the self, capital S. Sympathy with each thing, this is characteristic of the psychic nature. So he's again inviting us to the huge experience and what it means to be fully divinized, to be aware of the person with the capital P at the core of our being, that we're identical with that, even as we represent it in a portional aspect, that Amsha aspect, that is here, but at one with the universality, expressing itself uniquely through the individuality in the context of the collective whole, so that none of these, individually, familially, or in the transcendence beyond, are divided from each other. And yet, that transcendent being, even though establishing itself as a universal person and uniquely in all the distributed individuals populating the universe, is still above, beyond, while being within. This is the high realization in front of all our seeking and striving, and it gives the sure promise of a perfect reconciliation and transmutation of all the elements of our nature. A pure, total, and flawless action is possible only when that is effected and we have reached the height of this secret Godhead within us. So we have an idea of what we might do in terms of following Dharma on earth, of establishing a right order to our life individually and collectively, but the polity that we try to establish points to a unity, but only through the dividing mind, and so cannot achieve it. We can achieve that only with the founding spiritual realization, and then making that dynamic and powerful. The perfect supramental action will not follow any single principle or limited rule. It is not likely to satisfy the standard either of the individual egoist or of any organized group mind. It will conform to the demand neither of the positive practical man of the world, nor of the formal moralist, nor of the patriot, nor of the sentimental philanthropist, nor of the idealizing philosopher. It will proceed by a spontaneous outflowing from the summits in the totality of an illumined and uplifted being, will and knowledge, and not by the selected, calculated, and standardized action, which is all that the intellectual reason or ethical will can achieve. So he hints, when he refers to this illumined and uplifted being, at the supramental realization. Its sole aim will be the expression of the divine in us and the keeping together of the world and its progress towards the manifestation that is to be. So this is the Loka Sangraha of the Bhagavad Gita, Chapter 3, Shloka 2, holding together of the worlds, not simply of the peoples. The Loka of Loka Sangraha typically means the world is interpreted as being the peoples, but it's all the cosmos. All the cosmos is in the keeping of the divine consciousness. And he, she, who wants to work in concert with the divine will, takes all of this as part of the charge. There is no abstraction of human life from natural life, of the divine life from human life. All must be one. So that means our every action is secured in a responsible self-possession of the divine in us. The divine inhabits all this world. The divine is the Isha in the Isha Upanishad. So all this is the habitation of the Lord. So treat it like that. Treat yourself like that, you kings, you queens. But regard everything else also as kings and queens. All are beings. All have consciousness. Every stone you pick up, every pen you sign your name with, is instinct with the same divine consciousness that is at the center of your own being and which originated this world and remains beyond while within. Yes, it goes around and around. Its sole aim will be the expression of the divine in us and the keeping together of the world and its progress towards the manifestation that is to be. So it's not simply that we hold it together in the here and now, but there is a direction. There is an intention that wants to reach its goal. It speaks with us individually. Everything that we aspire to be is part of the cosmic will. It's right that you want to grow and move forward. It's right that you stop to assimilate and digest. It's right that you remember that you've been called to a greater future. All of this is right. This even will not be so much an aim and purpose as a spontaneous law of the being and an intuitive determination of the action by the light of the divine truth and its automatic influence. Well, we've spoken about the Gita and how it referred to that essential nature of the jiva as being the swabhava, your own being, and how that expresses itself in an ordered way in your dynamic nature is your law of becoming here, your swadharma. That is what plugs into the larger dharma of society, which should, in its own way, manifest the dharma that holds together the world order. All of these things should be fused. Ideally, they may be. We're trying to find a way to make them one in our human life and to lift ourselves out of a divided consciousness and live in true unity so that we can affect all of that. So this spontaneous law of the being is a wonderful thing to live from. We begin with that when we find the soul, living from the soul, from the psychic, and then enlarging that consciousness into the oneness of the self, of the spirit, of the Atman. And then in that fused realization, where one is a universal individual, rising to that next level, to the supramental level beyond. That we must do. It will proceed like the action of nature, from a total will and knowledge behind her, but a will and knowledge enlightened in a conscious supreme nature, and no longer obscure in this ignorant prakriti. So above, the originating nature of the Supreme Person, Purushottama, is the Paraprakriti, the Supreme Nature, which installs itself here in a provisional way as the Prakriti that we know. Prakriti is holding within it the secret of a supreme nature. We have to tickle it into wakefulness by evolving the spiritual consciousness in ourselves. It will be an action not bound by the dualities, but full and large in the spirit's impartial joy of existence. The happy and inspired movement of a divine power and wisdom guiding and impelling us will replace the perplexities and stumblings of the suffering and ignorant ego. Suggesting again that the higher nature descends into the lower. If by some miracle of divine intervention all mankind at once could be raised to this level, we should have something on earth like the golden age of the traditions, Satya Yuga, the age of truth or true existence. For the sign of the Satya Yuga is that the law is spontaneous and conscious in each creature and does its own works in a perfect harmony and freedom. Unity and universality, not separate of division, would be the foundation of the consciousness of the race. Love would be absolute. Equality would be consistent with hierarchy and perfect indifference. Absolute justice would be secured by the spontaneous action of the being in harmony with the truth of things and the truth of himself and others, and therefore sure of true and right result. Right reason, no longer mental but supramental, would be satisfied not by the observation of artificial standards, but by the free automatic perception of right relations and their inevitable execution in the act. The quarrel between the individual and society, or disastrous struggle between one community and another, could not exist. The cosmic consciousness embedded in embodied beings would assure a harmonious diversity and oneness. Now, this paragraph that we've just read gets greatly expanded in the closing chapters of The Life Divine, especially when he's writing about the Gnostic being. Because how it is that a being of knowledge and perfect love would establish itself and bring, in a sense, a radiant order to the life around is something that he wants to dilate upon. He wants to expand upon that. So here's the core of the concept. But he will spend pages and pages and pages writing this out again later, in just a few years. Some of this, of course, he's rewritten in 1932, touched up again in the early 40s. Some of it possibly after he's written those great pages in The Life Divine. We'd have to go back and see the papers themselves to know that and become scholars. In the actual state of humanity, it is the individual who must climb to this height as a pioneer and precursor. So yes, he's put a lot of emphasis on the context, on the collective, and the rightness of the individual to live in balance with the collective should give to the individual all the necessary freedom to develop itself, discover new laws, new possibilities, and bring them to the front. And yet the individual must remember the context and not go too fast or too far or transgress and bring what would be hurtful into formation. Has got to be responsible even in creativity. Of course, one can be divinely responsible and cause a rupture in an old dying order so that something new can come into being, as Krishna did during his life. A wonderful example in so many ways, smashing icons, violating dharmas which need to go, so that the Sanatana Dharma can survive. Not every ethical system finds its basis in the Sanatana Dharma. Back to the individual. His isolation will necessarily give a determination and a form to his outward activities that must be quite other than those of a consciously divine collective action. Now, when Sri Aurobindo revised this section that he took from the Arya, he placed this word outward there, and a form to his outward activities. The inner state, the root of his acts, will be the same, but the acts themselves may well be very different from what they would be on an earth liberated from ignorance. So this is a link of an inner awareness to the dynamism of action as one can realize the Atman, but also realize the inherent power in the self through the energy of the Atma Shakti. Realizing the Atman doesn't make you incapable. From an absolute silence, or how does he write it? In an absolute silence sleeps an absolute power. Nevertheless, his consciousness and the divine mechanism of his conduct, if such a word can be used of so free a thing, would be such as has been described, free from that subjection to vital impurity and desire and wrong impulse which we call sin, unbound by that rule of prescribed moral formulas which we call virtue. Spontaneously sure and pure and perfect in a greater consciousness than the mind's, governed in all its steps by the light and truth of the Spirit. A mechanism of his conduct, because conduct means that you have a template of how you should be, and you refer back to the template and you think, what shall I do next? But when the law is spontaneously active within you, the law, ritta, according to truth, bringing order in its action to the world, because it is supramental at its root, then you don't have to have a code of conduct anymore. It is self-born within you. But if a collectivity or group could be formed of those who had reached the supramental perfection, there indeed some divine creation could take shape. A new earth could descend that would be a new heaven. A world of supramental light could be created here amidst the receding darkness of this terrestrial ignorance. And this again touches upon his last chapters in The Life Divine. The ashram is of course the context here, because it should be or should have been a laboratory in which this greater consciousness was worked out at the scale of the human without having renounced any of the difficulties of human life, accepting them as part of the challenge so that it would be a real achievement. So he suggests that numbers are needed to fix concretely on earth this descent of the higher nature. It can't be done with simply an individual achievement. He knew that if he brought the supermental down into his own body, into his body, into the mother's body as well, it would not be enough to transform the globe, to manifest the supramental in a sure way. It requires a larger basis, a collection of people, a group. We find a group, we enlighten each other. We find the soul, we share that soul light with others so that a group soul can be established. We live in a higher consciousness. We radiate that so that all may participate in it, all feel impacted by it, be surcharged with its force and power. So from an individual realization to a collective realization, we move towards the supramental. Both must be there. In the Arya, the last sentence that he wrote in this original chapter referred to the guidance of the divine will within him, this illuminated individual. And that carries us to the next chapter, chapter 8, the supreme will. We'll take that up starting next week. But along this line, we go to Book 11, the Book of Everlasting Day, the Soul's Choice and the Supreme Consummation. Then shall the truth supreme be given to men. There is a being beyond the being of mind, an immeasurable cast into many forms, a miracle of the multitudinous one. There is a consciousness mind cannot touch, its speech cannot utter, nor its thought reveal. It has no home on earth, no center in man, yet is the source of all things thought and done, the fount of the creation and its works. It is the origin of all truth here, the sun orb of mind's fragmentary rays, infinity's heaven that spills the rain of God, the immense that calls to man to expand the spirit, the wide aim that justifies his narrow attempts, a channel for the little he tastes of bliss. Some shall be made the glory's receptacles and vehicles of the eternal's luminous power. These are the high forerunners, the heads of time, the great deliverers of earthbound mind, the high transfigurers of human clay, the firstborn of a new supernal race. The incarnate dual power shall open God's door. Eternal supermind touch earthly time. The superman shall wake in mortal man and manifest the hidden demigod or grow into the god light and god force, revealing the secret deity in the cave. Then shall the earth be touched by the supreme. His bright, unveiled transcendence shall illumine the mind and heart and force the life and act to interpret his inexpressible mystery in a heavenly alphabet of divinity's signs. His living cosmic spirit shall enring, annulling the decree of death and pain, erasing the formulas of the ignorance with the deep meaning of beauty and life's hid sense, the being ready for immortality, his regard crossing infinity's mystic waves, bring back to nature her early joy to live, the metered heartbeats of a lost delight, the cry of a forgotten ecstasy, the dance of the first world-creating bliss. The immanent shall be the witness God, watching on his many-petaled lotus throne, his actionless being and his silent might, ruling earth nature by eternity's law, a thinker waking the inconscient world, an immobile center of many infinitudes in his thousand-pillared temple by time's sea. Then shall the embodied being live as one who is a thought, a will of the divine, a mask or robe of his divinity, an instrument and partner of his force, a point or line drawn in the infinite, a manifest of the imperishable. The supermind shall be his nature's fount. The eternal's truth shall mold his thoughts and acts. The eternal's truth shall be his light and guide. All then shall change, a magic order come, overtopping this mechanical universe. Namaste, Jai Ma.